return from the depths of the Badland. With a gun and a knife and a waistband. With the war with the devil and Shaytan. He wore a bad toupee and a spray tan. So high now, hoping that I land. On a tie stick, moving through Thailand. On the radio, heard a plane hijack. Government being back like the crook crack.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the New Lookout Landing podcast, which at some point, I guess I'll stop calling the New Lookout Landing podcast and it'll just be the Lookout Landing podcast, which still doesn't really have a name, but I'm kind of rolling with this for now. I am Kate Prusser. I am managing editor of the Lookout Landing website. And joining me today, as always, is audio engineer, graphics wizard, and my close personal friend, Jose Rivera. Jose, how are you doing?
Hello. Hi. I'm good. How are you? Yeah.
Hello. Hi. Hi. How's it going? How's Arizona treating you these days?
Pretty nice. I mean, with the winter being actual cool temperatures and not triple digits, I am surviving still. It's nice. Reminds me of back home. So I'm good with it.
It's miserable here right now. The wind is just like, whoosh, just cutting right through you.
I miss that.
You might not be missing it today. I spent like an hour outside and I still can't feel my feet. Speaking of, I can't feel my face when I'm with you. John Troopin is with us again. John, my precious, how are you?
I'm doing well. Very glad to be here to help regulate our fourth member, keep him in check.
Yes, our special guest for tonight, John's best friend. Is that fair to say, best friend?
You could say I've been on the fence for about the last 14 years, but
oh boy,
he's doing okay.
And fellow writer at Lookout Landing, Grant Bronston. Grant.
Hello, hello. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Did I say your name right?
I always
get that S and the D wrong.
It's pronounced Bronston.
Are not Bronston. The only one, but you nailed it.
And you two, I mean, we had to have you on together at some point, but you two have been friends for, like, forever, yes.
Literally 7 years
grade.
Old. Yeah.
Indeed.
And what
you were
was
seven,
it,
I was six.
What was it that immediately showed you that this was going to be the foundation of, like, a lifelong friendship?
I think it was probably my outfit on the first day. The fact that anyone could befriend a blonde bowl cut kid with a bright orange Hawaiian shirt and a bright blue cast on his left arm, probably a good sign that this is a lasting thing.
See, Grant did the perfect thing, where he had a broken arm for one day. He comes in the first day, has a cast on his arm. Everyone immediately recognizes him, likes him, signs the cast. Next day, his cast gets taken off. So everyone knew him, but he never had to have the pain of actually having to struggle in class.
But were you always, like, cast kid for a while, or?
I don't remember being that.
Yes, that is what we called him.
They called him
I remember
kid.
It explicitly.
Finally shook it off in sixth grade, but took a while.
Me and Jack D and Jack S and Jack HC and Jack Stir all called you cast kid in the corner.
28-kid class, there were four people named Jack.
So tonight we have a fun evening planned for you in which we are going to go through the Mariners' past, present, and future. But before we do that, we want to start off with a new segment we're kind of kicking off at the top of the show here. Three things you need to know from this week. So, the first thing that you might be interested in this week is, obviously, Jerry's kind of done with his major moves, so we hope. Jerry's probably never done, but we're starting to move around like minor league pieces at this point. So, first thing, an interesting signing in Nick Hagedon. Did I say it right? Hagedon.
Nailed it.
Hagedon. You might recognize Hagedon's name. He is Northwest, born and bred from his people out in Idaho, and grew up in Sumner and went to the UW where he pitched with our old favorite little Timmy Lincecum. Hagedon had like sort of a checkered, little bit of a checkered career where he was with the Indians. He actually played for Maniacta when he was with the Indians and got frustrated once and punched something and fractured his left forearm. So he missed
the whole 2016 season, I believe.
Well, this was Whoa. Back in 2012 when he was placed on the minor league disqualified list.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was not that. I'm not sure if he had an injury. He did have an injury because he missed all of 2016. He pitched in the minors with the Brewers in 2015.
I believe a fractured elbow.
Fractured elbow, 2016. Yeah. All right. So he's talking about a bounce back candidate. I don't know if there's much to be super excited about there, but it is a signing that makes sense. And you know, he's a lefty. I love a lefty. Nice tall lefty.
The familiarity with ACTA is intriguing, and I believe in 2015, when I first looked at it, he had started incorporating a cutter, which is a staple of this organization, it seems, at this point. So perhaps they see him as someone who has the potential to develop. You know, he's still got good velocity, can throw in the mid-90s, and you know, if you can throw in the mid-90s from the left side, you're going to keep getting chances. So he could stick at home.
For sure. And, you know, he's got like a little bit of a Mimo-ish look about him. 6'5", lefty. Kind of that Mimo-ish face that's just a really nice...
What's a Mimo-ish face?
Like, just a really nice, generic, white guy-looking face.
I think she means lovable.
All right, so that's the first thing. Second thing, you want to cover this one, Grant?
Absolutely. Well, obviously, Jerry's been trying to stockpile relievers, which is why we're all very excited that Jesus Sucre will remain with the organization. The one-time, or maybe two-time pitcher, which is probably a better idea than keeping him at catcher, where he really just can't hit, but he is lovable and did have a wonderful end of the year last year. He will be staying in AAA. So for all of you who had the answer to the Jerry DePoto trivia question of which players have been on the 40-man from when he started to now, he's no longer part of that one, but he's still with the organization. He's behind, obviously, Mike Zunino. He's behind Carlos Ruiz. He's behind the newly acquired and quickly punned Tuffy Goswitch. But, you know, you can't have too much depth when you're a major league organization, and it's fine to pay for minor leaguers, or in Sucre's case, you know, about $100,000 over the major league minimum. So it's, you know, always nice to have more depth.
All right. Third thing, I think this goes over to you, John, as you're sort of the official spokesperson for it.
So it has been a good week in Mitch Haniger fandom, I think you could say. I wrote the 40 and 40 on our good friend Mitch, which was a lot of fun to do, and I was very excited to see that folks are sort of in the same place as me, and that we have, I think it's very exciting to see that we have a player, I'd almost forgotten what it was like to have a prospect that is immediately ready, who comes up and you think, oh yeah, all of these things should work. They do all of these things well. as opposed to, you know, well, it's possible that they'll do one thing well if everything goes right. Just to sort of have a prospect with a high floor actually make it to the big leagues. As opposed to last year where you had Marte, where it was like, well, you see all of the concerns and they could be good, but they could completely crater. So it's been fun to see Haniger's support and enthusiasm flourish, and a lot of people both within sort of Mariners fandom and sort of around baseball talking about outfield defense and talking about that as potentially the next little thing, like pitch framing, which maybe a few years ago was recognized as a skill but not necessarily fully appreciated as how valuable of a thing it could be that might be missed in the numbers and evaluations that we do. And so it's an exciting week in terms of recognizing what type of team Jerry DePoto and the Mariners are trying to build, which we're going to get into a lot in this segment.
And I mean, I don't know if it's possible for if it was possible for a person to trend within Mariners Twitter, Mitch Haniger would have definitely been trending this week, because
absolutely,
we've been saying a lot of nice things about him. I believe that you have coined a nickname for this outfield that we are very excited about. Can you talk about that?
So I was, as I was writing the piece and I'd been thinking about this, I threw out the name the Marine Layer for our outfielders just because so we've had this stretch of pretty much the entirety of Safeco Field's existence where fly balls just aren't going anywhere. And it has been discussed. It's the Marine Layer. It's the air. It's the damp Seattle mentality and the damp Seattle atmosphere. But for the first time in a long time, we decided we should actually build our roster and build an outfield to fill in all those big gaps out there in the outfield. And I figure a man-made Marine Layer can combine with the natural one pretty nicely. So
it's time to own that name.
Absolutely.
Yes, yep. Turn that into a positive for us instead of a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have last year especially, Safeco Field really became a haven for home runs.
It's true.
Yeah. Which was annoying.
It was fun and also quite confusing, but especially with the team that they've constructed this offseason with a number of flyball pitchers and with a few of the pitchers that we had sort of becoming flyball pitchers. There's going to be a lot of things to chase, so we might as well have folks out mm-hmm. there who know how to do that. And we haven't had a death to flying things for quite a while, but now we've got three of them.
Well, that maybe makes a nice transition into the first of our series when we talk about the past. And we're not going to go back to like 1977 or anything and work our way through all those years of Mariners misery. We're not going to go through Bill Bavese and his time. But I think it's worth maybe starting with Jack Z and discussing the Jack Z regime and what kind of a team he built and what he left. So most importantly, with an eye towards looking at what Jerry DePoto inherited when he took over. And what Jerry DePoto inherited was a prospect graveyard. Is that fair to say?
That is absolutely fair to say.
Where prospects go to die. I believe it was Ethan Novak, one of our writers, said he knows someone in the... He has a contact in the Aqua Sox organization, and some family, when they found out that their son had been drafted by the Mariners, were very, very unhappy and said, essentially, they're gonna ruin our kid. Oof. And you want that not to be true, but let's revisit some of these other names. Dustin Ackley, Nick Franklin, Danny Holtzen, DJ Peterson, although we'll get back to that one, Alex Jackson, Mike Zunino, and then let's also think about who we traded for. We traded for them when they were young, so I mean, I think you could still consider them quasi-prospect status. Justin Smoke.
Yep.
Jesus Montero. I mean, this is a long list of mostly failure here, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's just saying the names out loud in order like that just really bums me out.
It's a bummer. It's a real bummer. I mean, it's a bummer. It was a bummer to do the research for this. It is a bummer to talk about. There is probably... Okay, so with Ackley... Ackley is a confusing one with me because everything that he was in college, he became the opposite of in the major leagues, right? Like, he had great plate discipline. He had this amazing ability to judge whether it was a ball or a strike. And then he completely lost that in the major leagues after, after his one good rookie year aside. So I was like, well, I mean, could we say that that's just a fluke? You know, maybe prospects bust all the time. But when you list all of these names together, Occam's Razor says it's not the player, it's the system of player development, right?
Yep.
And we've seen that sort of expressed in snippets and in discussions, and whether it's been publicly stated by people from the organization or private things that we've heard, that at every level, you know, guys were getting a different set of instructions about what to do, you know, that there was no sort of organizational philosophy, and there was no consistency.
And if you go ahead.
I was just going to say, what's shocking is that, you know, all those guys you mentioned, Ackley, Smoke, Montero, these guys are all top 10, top 15 prospects in the entire game. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys, you know, though prospects do bust, top 10 or top 15 prospects very rarely bust. And we had what seems like all of them bust. I don't think that can be a coincidence.
Absolutely not. I mean, of all the names on that list, I think the one thing is Holton's shoulder blew up. I mean, that's just bad luck. You know, that's a rough time and you feel bad for the kid. That is the one where I'm like, okay, obviously that's well out of the organization's hands. But looking at the rest of them, you know, it's hard to believe that that wasn't just... I think that what... And again, I don't want to go too far forward here, but seeing Tyler O'Neill at FanFest talk about, wait, you mean I can hit for power and average? Like, why weren't you getting that earlier? I mean, I know we joke about how Tyler is kind of a meathead or whatever. He's more, he talks like this. You know, he seems like a stereotypical, like a background player in like an 80s movie where he's like in the weight room, you know, while the two leads are having a big discussion over the girl they think is pretty. You know, he's the guy doing like chin-ups.
That's very specific.
I might have just watched 16 Candles a while ago. Sorry. But, you know, I don't think that that's... Tyler is a good hitter and he has good instincts. I think that that's just... That it's that kind of a sea change, something that we think of as so obvious. Of course you can hit for power and average. Of course you don't have to just be a power hitter. Of course you should be able to control the zone and take walks. But this very, very basic thing didn't seem to be making its way down to the lower levels of the organization. And it just seemed like people didn't really care, you know? Like, they cared about getting themselves to the show. And this came out a little bit in the interview that I did with Ian Miller, talking about... Because he did Jackson 2 years. He did Jackson when they were the worst team in the league, and he did Jackson when they were the best team in the league. And the difference in mindset and approach, like, from an individual one to a team approach, a team-based approach... Jack Z left Jerry with a pretty pitted out farm system and a team that was old and not great in a lot of offensive categories. 14th in walks while being 6th in strikeout percentage. 23rd in average, 22nd in on-base percentage, although 12th in slugging. Because Jack Z.
Dingers.
Of course, all the dingers. All the right-handed power hitters. They were 28th in defense and 29th in base running. Yeah, that was the 2015 team. So that's what Jerry had to work with coming into this.
Well, I think something Jerry has said a lot, particularly recently, was the amount of negative WAR players that he inherited, which was a ridiculous amount of negative WAR players to have on the team.
And it seemed like six.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Like, we had Logan Morrison with a negative 0.2, Sucre negative 0.3, Zunino negative 0.5, Montero negative 0.5, Bloomquist negative 0.6, Ackley negative 0.7, Ricky Weeks Jr., negative 0.7. Like, that's what he had to work with. And it's just brutal.
Ricky Weeks Jr., a.k.a. the move that every single one of us was like, well, there's no way this is going to work. Even the most casual Mariners fan was like, this is a terrible idea.
And Jack Z was like, hold my beer.
We I'm very much in favor, in retrospect, of that move, because I barely remember him having 95 plate appearances and playing in 37 games. Jesus.
I sure remember watching him play left field.
But I was going to say, we have that one amazing photo of him looking like the ball is just true. About to, like...
explode in his face.
Exactly, which, you know... I don't know if that was going to change the complete and you know change the season completely for us. So I'm willing to have that one image be our penance, our payment.
A small price to pay.
I mean, if you're going to be bad, at least be hilariously bad, right?
Very true.
And the 2015 team
the
was
2015
hilariously
Mariners story.
They were hilara bad. They were awful. So I think when we talk about the 2016 team. And the changes that were made there. And we talk about the 2017 team. It's pretty amazing to look at the amount of change that has been affected. And I mean, you know, there's jokes made about, oh, Trader Jerry, he can't quit the trade juice. Like, he gets itchy if he doesn't make a trade for a couple hours. But, like, he had to make all of those moves. He had nothing to work with in the farm system, and he had a roster that really needed to be overhauled, and a roster that was really, really, really poorly built for Safeco Field.
Yep.
Which is, again, just something that the viewer at home, it was very much like the experience is kind of like being in a horror movie, right? And you're like, no, don't go down there. Don't go into Safeco with those horrible, unathletic outfielders. No, but then they do it anyway because we wouldn't have a show otherwise.
It's been I think we've had a sort of stretch of a lot of positivity towards a lot of things Jerry's done. And again, we'll get to that in the future. But I think it's maybe been in reaction to the fact that, obviously, Vasey, but like you said, every single move from the last 10 years almost, it has felt like this is, you know, you could sit at home and say, this is just isn't going to work. Like, none of this makes any sense. Why would you put a bunch of righty power hitters who do one thing in a place where righty power hitters always come to die? Like, just why would you put Mark Trumbo and Seth Smith and Logan Morrison in the outfield?
Hey.
When...
Do you want to know what Mark Trumbo was worth on defense in 2015?
I probably don't because I want to sleep tonight. Lay it on us.
-8.8.
Jeez.
Mm.
Do you want to know what Nelson Cruz was? -17.6.
Jeez. That's all right. Well, it was an improvement over Raul Ibanez, surely. So that was a good time.
So, I mean, those are that's what he was left with, you know, an outfield that consisted of Nelson Cruz and Seth Smith and Franklin Gutierrez and Mark Trumbo and Ricky Weed. I mean, it just goes on. And Austin Jackson, who wasn't awful out there, but was pretty awful on the bases.
Very awful.
Yeah. He thought he was fast, and he was not fast enough to steal bases, at least.
There was a streak where he kept on running. Kind of like Nori did last year.
Yep.
They thought they could steal bases, and they kept on doing it, and they kept on getting thrown out.
Red light.
It's like, they were like, don't run. He ran. And he's out.
And he's running, and he's out. Yeah, that was, I mean, again, it's like an identity thing. You know, he was brought here, and he's got this idea that he's fast, but just did not...
There was a back-to-back stretch in 2015 where in left field, Franklin Gutierrez, not unfortunately fun death-to-flying things, Franklin Gutierrez, but sapped of vitality, still Aww. Lovable. Hmm.
Still
lovable,
handsome,
but just
still handsome.
Wonderful, but not defensively adept. Franklin Gutierrez was in left field. Sean O'Malley was our starting center fielder, and Mark Trumbo was our starting right fielder. And then they decided, well... God. Let's see. That didn't really work out. We lost 10-1. Let's try something new. Goody, you can stay in left. Seth Smith, how about you run it out there in right field? And Stefan Romero, go ahead. Try out center field. How's it feel?
Are you serious?
Straight up.
I blocked that out of my memory. I do not remember that.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good thing, Jose.
Yeah.
That's your brain protecting you.
I just don't like getting hurt, I guess. I don't know.
That's good.
One thing that I think is interesting is every single time you have a general manager get fired, it's because the team probably did a little worse than they were supposed to, which means that there's going to be some natural room for improvement the next year. And this is true in any sport with a head coach or general manager. Mm. And so I think part of the improvement that Jerry DePoto has shown is probably because, you know, the end of the Jack Z regime did, you know, it ended so poorly. But it's also important to remember that the Jack Z regime started out really well. I mean, then we were building this speed and defense team. We were trying to build around actual death-defying things, Franklin Gutierrez. And, you know, we still had Ichiro when he was, you know, fast and good and not a shell of himself getting to 3,000 hits. And then once Tony Blangino left, whether it's coincidental or not, you know, he kind of abandoned the sabermetric dream of speed and defense and started just chasing dingers and exit velocity. And that's kind of when things started going all down south.
Grant, you worked for the team at a time.
I did for two separate summers.
For two summers. Do you want to talk about that experience at all?
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I think it was fascinating to be on that side, but, you know, I don't have that much to compare it to. I never worked for any general manager other than Jack Z, and I wasn't really seeing him a whole lot. But one of the things that really struck me was, you know, because he was such a baseball guy, right? He was this minor league player who became a scout and then spent his entire working career for decades and decades in the game. The team was run like, you know, like baseball guys running a team. And I think we've seen a trend in recent years, really since Moneyball was published, the extra 2%, I think, by Jonah Carey, about owners and teams being run like their companies and trying to have a more corporate feel. And I think that's what Jerry DePoto, though not having that typical corporate background, is bringing, and I think that's what we're seeing more with, you know, he talks about how he likes to go play in spreadsheets. You know, that's never something that Jack Z would have said.
No.
Absolute opposite. And so, you know, you're getting them, the teams are all becoming smarter, and I think the Mariners are joining that wave of trying to iron out all of the inefficiencies and play to their strengths. And this year, Jerry is realizing that, you know, let's play to the strength of a good defensive outfield and a bunch of hitters that are going to be able to hit well in Seattle and that will play well for, you know, given the thin roster he had to start out. And I don't want to disparage the many friends, but also very smart and incredibly baseball adept people that were and still are working for the Mariners.
Sure.
And I think they were chasing some of the right things. You know, they saw that. And one of the big focuses I remember was exit velocity, right? It was, you know, okay, well, we've got this marine layer keeping the ball down. Let's go find guys that can hit the ball really hard and we'll be able to hopefully beat that. And one of those guys that the exit velocity just absolutely loved is Nelson Cruz. And that one signing has worked out better than probably anyone in the entire world, save for Nelson and his family, could have predicted. You know, like there is no way that anyone thought this contract that he would still be a top shelf player or at least hitter going into the third year of this contract.
Yeah,
and even like someone like Logan Morrison, like you saw the ability there, like you saw, you know, he was someone who had incredible exit velocity numbers and. You know, we would see flashes. It just, in many of these cases, I think came down to, like we talked about, an inability to develop the talent and an inability to have a cohesive organizational mentality. You know, even with, you know, smart ideas and really smart people, you know, if the people playing the game and the people doing the coaching just aren't on the same page, you know, it absolutely. Sometimes it just isn't going to work out.
Yep.
Well, that sounds like a really good transition into talking about the present and where we are now. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will visit with the Ghosts of Christmas Present. Having looked into the Chamber of Horrors known as the Mariner's Past, we turn our attention to sunnier skies here in the Mariner's Present.
All right, so I know we're all feeling pretty good about the team this year. Fangraphs has the Mariners at 83 wins and 79 losses. I feel that's a little low, considering last year we had 86 wins. And I don't know, what do y'all think? Y'all think that's a little bit low as well?
Oh, that's
absolutely.
Low. I mean, they're a better team than they were last year. I think they don't have a sucking hole at first base. Theoretically, he could be a sucking hole, I guess. But they don't have a sucking hole at shortstop. And I don't know about Zunino. I just hope it's a push. It's a wash.
I was just gonna say I get why the projection systems are kind of being much more cautiously optimistic, but I'm willing to be more full-blown optimistic, and I don't think it's unrealistic that this team wins, you know, 86 to 90 games.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I'm at as well, because I think at worst, even with some injuries, that I don't think they're still that bad of a team. The depth is really nice this year, something that we really have never had before. So it's nice to see that. One of the other big things about this year, probably the thing everyone's most excited about, is the outfield. Yeah, this outfield is going to be really, really fun to watch. There was an article today, and I can't remember the writer's name. Subi? CB?
Yes, Subi.
Subi?
Subi.
He essentially put together this amazing formula.
Amazing fan post.
Yeah.
On the site.
Definitely recommend go checking it out. Mm-hmm. And it essentially says that this team is going to improve based on this formula he created, which makes sense if you read it, by 40%.
44.
What's that?
At 44, and it's actually 44. According to one of the commenters, that's a 44 percentage point increase, which would be 131% better.
And that was sort of piggybacked on by a Jeff Sullivan piece, not necessarily directly, but just looking at the projections and sort of the jump in last year's production to how much, you know, that the Mariners are the team that by a dramatic margin has improved the most this offseason defensively, mm-hmm. as a whole. But Jose, sorry, you were saying, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
the explanation there.
No, that's totally fine. I mean, because essentially I was just going to jump into, you know, who's playing in the outfield. I mean, we're going to have Jerod Dyson in left field, Leonis Martin in center, and gorgeous Mitch Haniger in right field. And
Handsome
Haniger. And, I mean, Jerod Dyson last year had a, what, 3.1 war? Obviously, most of that was from his defense. But his bat wasn't that bad, actually. I believe he had a 287 clip. Something like that.
278, 340, 388.
Yeah.
That's
pretty good.
And good.
94 WRC plus.
Only in 337 plate appearances.
Right.
So for a full season, you're looking at, you know, were he to keep that pace up, that's a 5-win season.
And that's pretty nice.
Now he's got Edgar.
That's the thing. I mean, I know it's easy for us to say that, but it feels like that's true. Like, that's a big factor of a lot of these guys that will have continued success is Edgar will fix them. Like, I mean, it's, I don't know. It's just one of those things that it's nice to have him around for that.
So, and Scott Brosius.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing I think is, like, especially Edgar has so much of the respect in the Latin community and the ability to be bilingual and everything. And just doubling that and having someone else is giving them that much more time to spend with each individual player and really address some of those things.
So I have a question for Grant about the sort of roster construction here, because we talked earlier on about how the shift has gone from these sort of righty power hitting players and just so strongly focusing on exit velocity and eschewing defense in many ways. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like having now a team that is so strongly committed to sort of speed and defense, do you think that that's going to work, or do you think that sort of having so many players that almost have the same role can be a problem for a team?
I think there's a couple different issues there. One is, can having guys in the same role be a problem? I think that's much more of a team chemistry kind of thing. You know, like, does it actually hurt to have multiple guys thinking that they're going to both be taking the same at-bats or the same plate appearances? And that goes in with the same thinking of, you know, does it actually make sense to always hit a guy seventh because he knows he's going to do better when he's hitting seventh compared to ninth, which right. I don't particularly put stock in, but I also stopped playing baseball after my senior year of high school, so I wouldn't say that I'm by any means anywhere close to an expert. But I think overall, what I like about this roster construction is that the guys in the current lineup and on the current roster, there's, you know, that, you know, we talked about this earlier, there's a high floor. You know, we're not taking any guys and just hoping that they can keep up this miraculous, you know, defense or hitting. I think that, you know, that Jerrod Dyson stat we quoted earlier, you know, we did not acquire him and the Royals did not trade him thinking that he could be a 5-win full-time player. We were both teams were aware of the fact that his defense is not as good as it was by WAR last year. But that said, you know, he's still a good enough hitter that if the defense regresses, he's still a very valuable guy to have. Mm-hmm. You know, there's plenty of reason to believe in, you know, Martin, in Haniger, or in Heredia should Haniger falter. You've got some studs in the infield. I think that there's enough balance here and enough different backup options should some of these less proven guys falter that we're more readily built to withstand any kind of issue.
And I remember in 2014, and I don't know if this was your guys' perception, but even that 2014 team that was so fun and so sort of surprisingly strong, it often felt like, well, they're going to have to hit three homers tonight, and that's the only way they're gonna win, right?
Yeah,
you know, that, three solo homers.
Exactly, yep. And so, you know, you had certainly a solid team, but you had a team that was built around hitting for power and hitting for more power.
don't forget about hitting for more power.
Indeed, you gotta remember that. But that's something that's a little bit volatile. You know, you have players that can hit, you know, players that can hit are not going to generally completely fall off a cliff for any reason. But mm-hmm. the idea that defense and speed are skills that by nature are very high floor skills, because, you know, if you're a fast rangy player like Leonis Martin, you're not just suddenly going to forget how to, you know, play. You're not going to get a hitch in your swing.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get a hitch in your running motion and suddenly just lose a bunch of range. You know, if you get hurt, obviously that's a different story, but mm-hmm. these are skills that you can trust the players to have even if they're not hitting, and even if, you know, you're having difficulties in other ways.
You're not going to go through a defensive slump.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, tell that to Kyle Seager and yeah, all of I mean, his it, weird yeah, season. Totally. But you know, but other than that, you know, it's when we talk about high, you know, a high floor, we've talked about all these pitchers that have the ability to go out there and just throw a bunch of innings. But the specific skills that they've targeted are the high floor skills that you have in baseball, and I think that's a really interesting way of constructing a team.
Yeah, for sure.
I agree. I was just going to say, I think the other thing that's nice about the team that's constructed is there still is enough power on the roster because, you sure. know, that 2014 team would try to get three runs by home run, home run, home run, whereas this team can go walk, single, home run, and get the exact same amount of runs from that. And I think that, allows for us to get the guys that will walk and get singles and get on base, put them in front of the big boppers, in front of, you know, Cano, Seager, Cruz, and then still have other skills that you get as a result of not just selling out for power.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was going to touch on, and more specifically about Leonis Martin. We were talking about his bat, and do you all think that he's going to have an improvement in his bat this year? Do you think he hits for more power than, 15 home runs last year?
I think he hits 20 this year. That's my hot take. Ooh, that's my hottest take.
I like that.
That's my super hot take. Have you seen his arms? He's yoked.
Yeah, there was, for those that didn't see it, there was a video he put up where he was training in the same city where Robinson Cano is from, swinging a sledgehammer at a tire. And he's got some guns on him now.
He's got some guns.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and he talked, I think there was a piece either today or yesterday about how he's been working with Cano.
Yeah.
To improve his swing. And we've now got, Martin, we've got Segura. I'm sure some of the other players, have been working with Cano. It's not a bad person to have half your team modeling their swings on. Robinson Cano. So I think if he's healthy and he is in the same place as he was at the start of last year, which there's no reason to think he wouldn't be, I think he matches that power. And I think he'll be helped by the fact that he doesn't have to play every single game and he can get a day off occasionally and the team's not going to fall off a cliff. So.
Or he can go play left field. Even just not having to be in center all the time, although I think his personality is one that he wants to be in center. He does not get any days off either. Remember, Service told us he's too annoying in the dugout.
Right. Exactly.
The day off.
I think he'd be an elite defensive right fielder.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. With that arm can absolutely play in right. This is Ichiro basically you're talking about in right field.
Ooh, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. That's nice to think about. And going back to what you were saying about that he can have a day off now. So if he does injure himself, God forbid, slide over Gerard Dyson or Mitch Haniger, and then you can bring in Guillermo or maybe Gamble. I don't know. We'll see.
He's already been eaten by a bear. Remember.
And the bear is Boog Powell.
And that's another guy.
And that was what set off his test. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Turns out cannibalism is a
banned substance.
A banned substance, yes.
And that's the luxury of the depth that we have on this team this year is we won't have to see Nori in center field. If Leonis were to take a day off or get injured. So that's really nice to see. And the infield, just the defense all around, I guess I should say. And I mentioned this in the last episode. That's the biggest thing that I'm excited for this year because you've got a good defense. Your pitchers will be more confident. They'll be able to work with different stuff in the zone. And I think everybody's going to benefit from that. So that is why I'm very, very high on this team's chances this year.
When you have players that... I do worry a little bit about sort of the depth at a few positions.
Sure.
We talked about catcher already. But it's interesting that sort of the second string and the third string at each position, other than maybe shortstop, where we don't really have another option, they're very much the same type of players. And I think while that can be frustrating from a upside perspective, that helps from a consistency perspective where, pitchers can go out there and say, okay, Leonis has a day off, but Gerard's out there and Guillermo's out in left and I'm not going to have to worry about the range completely falling off, because it's not, oh, now Goody's out there. And
Stefan Romero's not in center field.
Exactly. Oh. Well, and speaking just from a playing perspective, that makes such a big difference when, you know, if I was never a great defensive player or playing many defensively impactful positions. I played first base when I wasn't pitching for the most part. But even in that situation, knowing that the person, you know, if your shortstop has a day off, you have to worry about, oh, does the backup have the same sort of mentalities? Are they going to be able to get to these balls? Mm-hmm. You know, so having players who consistently have similar range, similar skill sets, it just makes it easier for, you know, you take one piece out of the machine, you plug something else, you take one cog out, you put another cog that's essentially the same cog right back in. Everything keeps flowing, you know, everything keeps flowing in the Jerry machine.
Everything keeps flowing in the Jerry machine. Well, I think that's maybe a good place to end on the present. And when we come back, we'll have Grant tell us a little bit about the future. And wear a tiny pair of hands. Finds a seaworn piece of glass and sets it as a sapphire in her mind. And there she stands. Welcome back. We are now going to continue our tour through the history, present, and we have landed on the future of the Mariners franchise. And Grant, who has a passion for contracts, because there's a lid for every pot, is going to lead us through that.
Yeah, I'll be honest. This passion of mine probably just means I've spent way too much time with Microsoft Excel in my life. But I think
you and Jerry, you're like Lookout Landing's Jerry. You relax with a nice hot bath and a nice spreadsheet.
Based on the amount of different video games that we have spent most of our time working through the off season of to playing together in dynasty mode or franchise mode, I can attest.
Well, I was gonna cite the fantasy football spreadsheet in our fantasy football league.
Absolutely.
Where I have automated standings and records and head-to-head matchups and a whole bunch of very useless things that no one actually cares about, but, you know.
We love still, it.
Yeah, or at least I love doing it, which is all that matters, I suppose. But yes, the future. So the first thing I want to say before I get into anything else is the major caveat that there's a chance that between when we are recording this podcast and when it is actually released that Jerry will have added to the 36 trades he has already made. And the future plan that I'm laying out here will be in no way, shape, or form similar to what it actually is. but the biggest thing to know is that right now the team payroll this year is $146 million, which is, you know, a lot. That's, I want to say, right around 10th or 12th in the major leagues. Right around 10th. Does that sound right?
Yeah, around that area.
So it's, you know, we're in the upper tier, but comfortably, you know, in that middle class still. We're not close to the Dodgers or the Yankees or the Red Sox. And basically, after 2017 and 2018, we lose control on a lot of guys, and there's a lot of payroll flexibility. So what does that actually mean? I mean, the biggest thing is that Jerry's done a great job adding young guys that are controllable, that can take on major roles for years to come. Obviously, you know, Mike Zunino is already in place, and he'll be, you know, team control until 2020. But guys like Dan Vogelbach, who 6 years of control, he's good until 2022. Segura is going to be a Mariner through 2018. But both Guillermo Heredia and Ben Gamel, our favorite Ben Gamel, are here till 2022. Mitch Haniger is here till 2022. Practically every single random pitcher that was added this offseason to be our number seven starter is here through about 2022. You know, Ariel Miranda is here through 2022. So, you know, there's a lot. These guys are around for a long time. And unless they all spend, you know, the entire year on the major league roster, there's a good chance they'll even the service time will roll over. They'll be here through 2023.
Jerry has done a lot of talking about that youth core and how important he's seen it to build the youth core.
Yeah.
And not trade from it. So this is all kind of backing that up.
And something else that's interesting is we have a number of guys that have between 2 to 3 years of major league service time. And so, you know, in case everyone here is not quite as much of a junkie on how service time works and how the CBA all works, basically once you hit 6 full years of service time at the beginning of a season, you are then a free agent and you're able to sign with anybody. Until then, you're under team control for the first 3 years. You get the minimum salary. The next 3 years, you get an arbitration-determined salary. So we have a lot of guys that are at that 2 to 3 mark where they're either making the minimum or they're in their first year of arbitration. So these are guys like James Paxton, Mike Zunino. You've got this big core right there. But you also have a lot of guys who are between 0 to 1. So that's where you've got Edwin Diaz, Haniger, Gamel, Dan Altavilla, Dan Vogelbach. But there are actually only 3 guys on the roster right now with 1 to 2 years of service time. And those 3 guys are Chris Heston, Sean O'Malley, and Tony Zick. So not exactly core players. For whatever reason, there's a lot of flexibility in that little window years down the road to really add when those guys aren't a big part of the team and you're saving some money on arbitration and the guys below them are still making the minimum. But
wow,
the 2019 roster is where I start to get worried because we have $71 million committed to 3 players. And those 3 players will be a 36-year-old Robinson Cano, a 33-year-old Felix Hernandez, and a 31-year-old Kyle Seager.
I feel okay with 2 of the 3 at that age.
Yes.
Because I feel that Robbie will probably either be in the DH role at that point or maybe first base.
First base.
Yeah, you can do first. And I have a feeling Kyle Seager will play a long time, much like Adrian Beltre. Like, they'll just stay consistent for a long time. So I'm not too worried about Seager. Felix?
Bullpen arm! Bullpen,
yeah,
Felix!
I don't know. We'll see. I guess that's the only one I'd be concerned about.
Felix, if he's physically out there pitching, then I think he's going to be fine. I don't know that he would benefit much from going to the bullpen, just because he never seems like he's holding back velocity. So I think it'll just be more of a process of him being more physically diligent, which I think all the work he's putting in now is probably honestly going to be helpful next year as much as it is going to be this year, just because if he keeps that up, it's going to show dividends in long term. And then also finding the way to go from being like Bartolo Colon, for instance, where Bartolo was throwing 96, 97, 98 early in his career, and he learned to be a guy who just painted the corner and was content with letting guys hit the ball if they needed to. So yeah. He's an adjustment maker. He just has to make this one.
And I think we've seen Felix make that adjustment earlier. You know, he's gone from the young, you know, 19 and 20-year-old in the bigs who was throwing, you know, high 90s and starts to lower velocities. We just need to, you know, he needs to keep adjusting and keep learning how to pitch with the changing skill set and tool set he has.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of people make the immediate comp to what Verlander did recently. That, you know, it kind of changed the way they pitched. And I think, I've seen some people say, like, well, Verlander did it, Felix can do it. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens there.
So by 2019, that entire rotation is going to be very different because Paxton is under control through 2020, which is quite nice. But what's worrying is that Paxton and Felix are the only starting pitchers under control. So You know, Kuma has a team option for next year. I believe it's actually, I'm not sure if it's a team option or a vesting option. Giovanni Gallardo has a team option that will, barring a miraculous bounce back year, almost certainly be bought out. For like, I think it's $2 million buyout. And then Drew Smyly is a free agent after 2018. And unless you're willing to trust, you know, Chris Heston and all the random guys, you know, Ariel Miranda, unless you're willing to trust those guys as your third starter, I'm guessing that that Jerry will have made moves to acquire new blood for the rotation well before then.
Unless you are missing rotation stalwart Andrew Moore.
Yes.
Come on.
Right. We do have Andrew Moore, who's not too far off from the bigs. And then a little further off, we've got Nick Neidert, who is the, I believe, the Mariners, their first pick in the draft that also netted Andrew Moore. He's a high schooler from, I want to say, like, South Carolina, Florida or something. Maybe I'm making that up. But we've also got Rob Whalen, nice guy, as we have previously monikered him, Rob Whalen, as well as Max Posey. Posey? Am I saying that right?
Posey. Nailed it. Like Posey with a V.
Okay, Max Posey. Both those guys are, you know, good depth pieces and nice to have, but I, you know, I don't think anyone thinks that they have a ceiling much higher than being a 4 or 5 starter, and even that might be a stretch. So this team will be relying on a number of trades. They'll also be, you know, shedding about $45 million in payroll each of the next 2 years, although some arbitration raises will eat into that. And it'll be interesting to see whether Jerry changes his kind of preferred methods of improving the team by adding more free agents. You know, we've seen, I think the only multi-year free agency deals he's given have been to Steve Cishek and to Mark Zepchinski, which is kind of shocking when you think about that. You know, that's how much he avoids these multi-year deals. He does not give them to anybody.
Well, if you came out of the Angels organization, you probably would feel similarly.
And we, where I believe it was when DePoto was on the Ringer podcast, actually, recently, and he was talking about sort of the different ways in which he's gone about constructing teams when he's been in charge. When he was briefly in charge in Arizona, and he looked at that team and felt they needed to get younger and needed to get certain types of players, and they acquired, I think, a number of young pitchers. I remember Tyler Skaggs in particular, only because he traded for him twice, which was a fun little piece. But and then when he was with the Angels, obviously he had sort of a bit of a power struggle, but that it was a different situation, that he's not someone who comes in with the idea of this is the way that it has to work, and that he has looked at the Mariners and looked at what has been available in free agency and what the market is allowing for and said, this is the best way for this team to be constructed based on what's available. And that kind of flexibility is, I think, a unique, maybe not a completely unique, but I think it's a very admirable characteristic and something that you don't always see in people who have the personality to want to run a team and run an organization.
I'm particularly interested in the fact that in what you were talking about, you're talking about who we have coming up for the pitchers. The only homegrown names there are Neidert and Moore. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is someone he's traded for.
Yeah. And I think it's what's interesting is, you know, on that same Ringer podcast, he talked about free agency was, you know, when you're signing free agents, you're signing guys who are most of the time on the wrong side of 30. And it's very much a short-term kind of win-now proposition where, you know, if you're signing them to multi-year deals, then the first year or two, they're great, and then they're not worth it by the end, but you got more production by the beginning. And that's the whole premise of the Robinson Cano deal, right? No one thinks that, 41-year-old Robinson Cano is going to be worth $24 million. but the thinking is that 31-year-old Robinson Cano is worth much more than $24 million.
Right.
Whereas trading, it is much more flexible, right? It allows you to go find those young guys like Rob Whalen or Max Posey that you can plug into the rotation and, you know, have work from a young age. But the problem is that you really have to be confident and trusting in your system and willing to say, you know, it's okay if Taiwan Walker ends up hitting big down the road, because given the information we had, we thought that, you know, we'd rather have Yan Segura and Mitch Haniger. But I also think it'll be interesting to see which minor leaguers make a big impact. And Jose, I know that you're much more of a minor league expert than I. Do you have any particular favorite minor leaguers you think that we could see on the field, you know, maybe not even this year, but 2018 or 2019 making a big impact, or even later?
Well, expert, I mean, you're being really generous with that. Obviously, you got guys like Kyle Lewis and Tyler O'Neill who will contribute to the team in the next few years. My guy that I want to keep an eye on is Brian Hernandez.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's got a lot of tools. He's still a little bit raw, but just from seeing his numbers and updates from Mariners minors, you know, when they provide updates from his games, you know, sometimes he'll go like 4-for-4 or 5-for-5 with like 2 doubles. Like, he'll just have like crazy, incredible games. That's a guy I think if they keep him in the system, especially with the current way that they're with their philosophy, I think the sky's the limit for him. Like, and it may be irrational for me to think that because prospects are boom or bust. But I have really high hopes for him. I'm really excited about what they can do with someone like him.
I was just going to say about Hernandez, I mean, a switch-hitting 19-year-old who was given almost $2 million a couple of years ago, there's a lot to dream on there, no doubt.
Yeah.
I think that's especially interesting considering we've had some frustrations about the lack of activity in the international market, that a player like Hernandez, who, especially with DePoto switching up so many features of the farm system as a whole, has still been able to see flashes of success and has been able to be comfortable coming in. That's good to see. I have a question for Grant that I'm happy to extend to both of you as well, but depending on if it would apply. But I know that you, Grant, are a avid player of out-of-the-park baseball.
Yes.
Which is a fantastic sort of baseball simulator. And I'm curious if there's a player that you, in your time with the Mariners, have grown any sort of affinity towards purely out of playing that game, which is an incredibly robust representation of the entire league.
Well, unfortunately, I'm about to kind of perhaps undercut your robust interpretation of the entire league by saying I have seen DJ Peterson become a star player and a star,
this is fair.
A star left fielder in that game.
So,
okay.
You know, I've also seen Gareth Morgan, you know, learn to strike out a lot less. But no, I think, well, firstly,
even robots have dreams.
It is a great game, and I think what's fun about it is just, you know, every time you sim through it, you realize these prospects, you know, anything can happen, right? They, like, some guys will figure it out, some guys won't, and that does bring me back to the Andy McKay, Jerry DePoto player development mantra that's throughout the organization. And, you know, it's hard not to have hope that whatever picks we have, whatever guys we draft, and, you know, it's nice to not sign big free agents so we get to keep our first-round picks, but whichever guys we do end up selecting, I feel confident trusting them in this player development system. And, you know, I think that we're in a nice enough spot that we're going to be able to pick guys, the best talent available at the spot, and within a couple of years they'll be in the majors. And you know, you don't really draft for need in baseball, and I think it's nice that there's now enough depth that you really don't need to feel pressed, especially in the bullpen, since that's the most obvious draft for need, to take a Jacob Lindgren to get him up to the bigs earlier. Brandon Finnegan or someone like that. But you know, we've got some good relievers, and this is also I'm segueing so I can talk about one of my favorite random prospects who could become quite a reliever, and that is Thiago Vieira.
Mm. Yes.
Yep.
You're in good company here.
Yes. I'm ready to talk about beatboxing Thiago Vieira.
I mean, all I see there is, you know, an incredible fastball. You know, MLB.com has it as a true 80 out of 80 grade fastball.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you have that, you have any semblance of control, and you're very possibly a major league reliever.
I think Thiago is absolutely a major league reliever. He developed a second pitch, so he's got a slider. I think it's a slider, right? Anyone read that Divish article? Yes. It's a slider. Because it's always a slider. Of course it's a slider. Our entire bullpen is fastballs and sliders.
As Ethan outlined today.
As Ethan outlined in his great article, the Mariners bullpen will throw all the sliders. somebody in that organization knows how to teach a slider or a cutter or whatever it is. And Vieira is another story that, you know, you get really down on the farm system, and it's easy to because there's so much negativity about it and so many negative things. But, you know, Vieira spent 3 years, 4 years? How long has he been in the system? They had to rule five him this year.
They actually signed him in 2010.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was...
Yeah. He has been rattling around in our system for a long time. I think they signed him, and then he went and pitched in the World Baseball Classic for Brazil. I think that's right. I mean, he had this great start. He was kind of the hero of the World Baseball Classic. He got the last outs to secure a win over, I think it was Panama. And he had all this buzz, and then he just kind of disappeared. And he was just floating through the system for, you know, he was a starter, and then he was a reliever, and... Ethan Katz, the pitching coach, just really took an interest in him and was like, this is going to be my guy. I'm going to get this guy and I'm going to get him right. And I just feel like it's such a testament to what we can do with better player development. There's a lot to dream on here, right? Like, we've built a youth core that we didn't have before. And Jerry is out there making trades, turning 85 cents into a dollar on the daily. So, I mean, yeah, it's easy to look past 2019 and feel some fingers of doom descending slowly, clasping Safeco Field in their icy grip. But no, resist that. Resist. Resist the pessimism. Believe in Jerry. I am all in... I have had it wasn't Kool-Aid at Jonestown, it was something else, and poor Kool-Aid got mixed up with that for all time, but I'm drinking the DePoto Kool-Aid. All right, well, I think that maybe sums up our discussion of the future, and when we come back, we are going to answer some of your Twitter questions. I be more than a god in my dreams. It's wishful thinking. I sleep more than I need to. I drink more on the weekend. I eat all meat but fish. I keep my knees with me. I see sharks in the water. I fiend for marijuana. I pray for all my homies. I'm lying, at least I try. I say that she's my only, but got you on my mind. Today I'm only human, but know that when I die, my grave. Welcome back. Now is the time on the podcast when we answer your questions. And Jose is the question master.
That's me. All right. First question we have is from Josh Cow. And he asks us, when is the next meeting of the Mitch Haniger fan club? Mm. John.
I have a text from Josh's head coach. Said, moved this Sunday's Garfield baseball indoor workout at Athletic Forum up to 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. To try and avoid these Super Bowl parties. 12 p.m., Josh, after I finished teaching many, many pearls of wisdom for pitching, we will have our daily meeting.
There you have it. All right, next question we have is from David Weirs, and he says, My A's lost to Seattle in the season opener in 2007, in 2010, 11, 12, and 13. How badly do you miss opening the year against us?
Oh, I want to take a second and give a shout out to David Weirs, who wrote for us for the site for We Asked an A's Fan, and it was very, very funny. And we are so sorry you're an A's fan. And also, we miss opening the season against your team.
Yeah, specifically this year with opening against the Astros, which, yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Although I do want to mention that right after those A's losses to the Mariners in 2007, Seattle decided to then travel to Cleveland to play a four-game set in Cleveland, and all four games were snowed out, and they then had to make up each of those games throughout the rest of the season. And the first game of that four-game series that never happened, the Mariners were just one pitch away from a five-inning no-hitter against Paul Byrd. So there is a blast from the past, 2007 edition. You are welcome.
Nice. Yeah,
if you're looking for a blast from the past, 2012 edition, it was very fun to open the season at Oakland in Japan on March 28th. Play another game that next day, and then take another week off before continuing that same series in Oakland again. So, miss it quite a bit. Tom Wilhelmsen got the win. Brandon Lee got the save. Wow. In 11 innings.
Oh my God.
That is a blast from the past. All right, next question we have is from Dylan Jenkins, and he asks, what Mariner of the past, who was at the time decidedly average, be decidedly not average today?
I am going to throw it back to my first year of Mariners fandom that I can really remember, when I was 8 in 1988. And Steve Balboni, who we only had for 1 year, Steve Balboni put up the 10th highest WAR on the team that year. At 1.0 WAR.
Love it.
Good Lord.
So he hit, I think it was like 250 as a utility player. He's a utility player. He slashed 250, like 300, 480, and was the 10th most valuable player on the team. So wow. I would say that was a player who seemed not average. He was extraordinary. Who really, by all measures, is like a completely ordinary player. Oh, it was fun times being a Mariners fan in the late 80s.
I would like to see Shigetoshi Hasegawa, one of my favorite relief pitchers from the early 2000s. He was very serviceable. I enjoyed getting Shiggy with it from time to time. And I think we need him back. I think he'd fit in very well in the pile.
My vote is for a player who I actually... So, this player, Carlos Guillen. Yes. I have a classic Christmas list from when I was like 7 or 8 years old, where I had like 5 things on it, including Pokemon cards. But one of the things, for whatever reason, was a Carlos Guillen jersey. And I never got it. I'm still bummed about it. But I remember him as the guy that came in after A-Rod and was okay to whatever. But, you know, in 2001, he was worth 3.3 wins. And, you know, he ended up being great with Detroit, which I still hold against the city of Detroit to this day. But he was a very solid to very, even good, like a, shortstop for 3 straight years.
I thought you were going to say new lungs for him, since he was so unfortunately afflicted with illness during that stretch of time, and it was just such a new thing. But a jersey seems much more appropriate.
I have lost a Mariners trivia contest before because I named him as part of the 2001 ALDS roster. When he was not on the roster because of tuberculosis.
Unfortunately. That was the difference.
Yeah.
That was the difference.
That's why I did not win the Mariners Fan Fest contest. Came in second.
All right. Next question we have is from Benjamin Kasperson. What is the best nickname for a player on the M's of recent memory? Example, the King, Condor, Vogdor, etc.
Vogdor. Big Tuna. I mean, now that we know, we can call him Big Tuna.
You know, John brought up Big Hoss the other day.
Hoss.
Just Hoss. You know, there's Hoss. Not a Big Hoss. Big is implied.
<It's> implied.
This is true. It's just Hoss.
It's a
just
silent Hoss. Big.
I feel like pitchers always have really good nicknames.
I like Shiggy. I mean, getting Shiggy with it was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
It's a pleasant sound, but it's not a particularly creative nickname.
No.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
Jose, you really didn't like Gilly for Guillermo.
Well,
which was my fake nickname that I was sure Sims was going to come up with if he started getting more playing time.
I think they do. I think they do call him Gile, something like that. I think that's
who is
the
they?
Short form. Like his that's teammates.
Who is they?
His teammates call him that.
Okay, that's fair.
He does have a badass nickname though, and it is El Conde.
El yep.
Conde.
The Count. I love that name. The Count.
And he calls his parents Il Conde and La Condesa, so it's kind of cool. He hashtagged that in a birthday photo that he made for himself on Instagram. Awesome.
is this while he was just hanging out live?
Oh man, I hopped right up into that he was drinking a beer and eating some tacos and
as you should.
Engaging with his people.
Good
I did not understand awesome. One word out of his mouth. He talks so fast. But yeah, I think I love El Conde. Yeah, I'm going to go with that.
That's actually mine, because when they first signed him and I was looking him up, that was the first thing that they said was his nickname. And I was like, oh my God, I love that.
Badass.
And awesome. that's got to be my favorite right now. Non-Felix sure. edition.
And throw out a couple more, just death-defying things. Is
sure,
a wonderful
yeah.
nickname, and though it's not very inventive, I do love the bartender for Tom Wilhelmsen, because sure.
yes
man, I wish he would be my bartender sometime.
Well, you might have that come to fruition. I would also like to throw out a retro nickname that I thought was badass when we called Norm Charlton the Sheriff.
Yeah,
so that's mm-hmm. a badass relief pitcher name.
All right, next question we have is from Kevin Delosto. Can Jesus Sucre actually hit now, or just a hot month? Just
no.
a hot month.
Next question.
Just a hot month.
Just a hot month.
In his three previous major league seasons, the sum of his OPS plus was 79.
Oh.
Good God.
Oh, we love you, Jesus. We just,
yeah.
Just we know. Love you in Tacoma.
All right, the next question we have is from Elias Hyam. And he asks, in the next 5 years, what percent of the current 40-man roster will remain? It's kind of a tough one.
The Cano part?
Yeah. Obviously, yeah, Cano, Felix, Seager. Well,
maybe Seager will be a free agent, but a team option. So probably still.
Oh, okay.
Zanino, maybe?
Diaz.
Altavilla.
The maybe. Only guy, yeah, the guys under team control would be Cano, Seager, Diaz, you know, maybe Ariel Miranda or Heredia, Haniger, Altavilla, Vogelbach, and fringe guys that I don't think will be on the team in 5 years.
5 to 10%?
You mean number one starter Dylan Overton? You're talking about.
I was actually referring to future all-world center fielder Ben Gamel, but...
Ooh.
Ouch.
I want to know what alternate dimension you're living in.
The one where Mike Freeman is also on our 2022 roster.
So, do we think maybe 5 to 10%? 10%?
I think 10% is fair. So four.
That's four players.
That's four players.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
All right, next question we have. Christian Bothell. Who is currently the most overrated Mariner?
None of them. They're all underrated.
I find them all to be properly rated.
Yeah. The only one I would have said for this was Taiwan Walker, and he's gone now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we're going... I mean, it's hard to say. If we're talking, like, nationally, I don't know that anyone on this team is particularly overrated. I don't think there's a significant amount of hate for this team. There's just not that much... I think there's a lot of apathy. we might, as a fan base, be overrating Iwakuma.
Yeah,
I can see that.
That he, you know, he does, you know, not what he has done, but just what he realistically has the likelihood of doing. You know, and that his vesting option could be a real pain if he's just gets there barely, but has health struggles all year. So I really don't want that because I love watching him pitch and he's a fantastic guy. But he I think is someone that I could see us believing in and this team putting a lot of trust in, and him just not physically having much left.
That's fair.
I would like to be proven wrong.
I think you could also make a case for our newly acquired shortstop, Mr. Segura. I think most of the fans are realizing that, and you know, are saying that his breakout season last year was a bit of a fluke, and he will likely not repeat that. And I think that is true. I think he will still be a very, very good player, but there's a chance that he will return to being the not very good player he was for, you know, the better part of two seasons before that. And there are plenty of reasons that he was, you know, not as good, and there are plenty of reasons to believe that he will be much better than that, much closer to his 2016 version. Mm-hmm. But I think anyone who expects last year as the new norm could very well be disappointed.
That's fair. I agree with Segura. All right, next question we have is from Seahawks Crazy. It's an apt Seattle-based name. If Paxton craps out, is the season shot? And the other part of that question is he the highest leverage player on the 25-man?
I think there's a good possibility that if Paxton gets some horrible injury and can't pitch, it's that's a hole. That's a real hole. Because a lot of it, he's the only thing approaching an ace pitcher that we have. Everything else is, you know, depending on some bounce back from Gallardo, depending on Felix to be semi Felix-ish. Depending on Drew Smyly to not give up a zillion dingers. Everything else is so delicately hanging. It has to break right. The only ding on Paxton is he has this history with weird health problems. So, you know, hopefully the new arm slot solves a lot of that. The fingernail is healed. I don't think there's a high possibility that he craps out, as you say. But I think that if he does, if something happens, if he gets a weird comebacker like he did last year, which I don't think I've ever felt more sick. I was at the game for that. I don't think I've ever felt more sick than when I saw, and I'm apologies to Matt Shoemaker because I was also at that game, but I was way out in the pen and I couldn't really see it. So I'm going to give myself a pass on that one.
Hey, we need to talk about your hexing. It's getting out of hand. It started with Adam Lind, and that was okay, but got some concerns.
My stomach felt like it was just going to fall through the floor because if he wasn't able to finish the season, I don't think we would have been able to hang in there as long as we did. So
yeah.
I totally agree. I think he is the key to the 2017 season. No pressure, James.
Well, and I think the thing, obviously the injury is a big concern, but from what he's talked about recently, like at the luncheon, he mentioned how he realized that his arm slot was starting to go back to where it was, and he recognized that, and he fixed it. He made that adjustment. So I don't think there's going to be an issue in terms of his pitching mechanics. Like, I think he's got it figured out, and if he starts to drift, he's going to adjust it, go back to where he needs to be. And, I think this rotation is going to rely on him a lot. I think he's going to be the guy this year in that rotation.
Mm-hmm. And just to chime in on Paxton, I think if he's out, then any chance we have of winning the division goes with him.
That's fair.
That's probably a good call.
Yeah. Next question is from Jeff McMahon. What is your favorite one-year Mariner, and why is it Deho Lee?
Aww. It was last year. I mean,
yeah.
Aww. He just provided so many highlight moments, and while not being Adam Lind, that even when he struck out, I was like, oh, it's okay. This year, it's probably going to be Gerard Dyson, right?
Where he go, the champagne flow.
Absolutely.
I love that.
It's an amazing quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, just predictive. Like, so what if, you know, the worst case scenario, Gallardo doesn't bounce back, Paxton, like, I don't know, an anvil falls on his head or something. You know, just everything bad happens. Gerard Dyson is going to be fun, no matter what. Yeah. Like, we are going to get to watch walk-off interviews or dugout interviews, something. We're going to get to listen to him talk. We're going to get quotes. Gene Segura is going to make funny faces. Like, it's going to be a fun team to watch, no matter what.
Dyson's going to steal home this year. That's my prediction. And then in the post-game interview, when he's getting Gatorade, he's going to say, that's what speed do.
Can we make a prop bet on this? Is that how that works? A prop? I don't know what a prop bet is.
Well, he said that before. At FanFest, somebody asked him about the time where he stole second to third in the World Series, and his response was, that's what speed do. And, yeah, I'm really excited for him. He's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun characters on this team.
Good prop bets would be a nice podcast topic at some point. And
I like it.
A good one would be, does a Mariner steal home in 2017?
I'm all for it. Next question we have is from CTown51. How will you measure the success of the 2017 Mariners? That's a very good question.
Make the playoffs.
Does it have to be a wild card? Does it have to be wild card berth?
At least.
Yep.
Oh, I mean, they're Astros. Come on.
No, I mean, I don't expect any more than that, I think. But I think being in the playoffs, like Grant said, if it's less than that, I think I will be disappointed. I certainly think it's a long, you know, there's a lot that needs to go right, but I think this the Robbie Nelson Felix that we still see the little bit of the glimmer in before he may or may not reinvent himself, but the Felix that we still see a little bit of that shine in, you know, that's right now, and we need this team to kind of come together and make it happen. You know, you have Dyson for this year, you have Valencia for this year, you have a bunch of players that are probably as good as they're going to be right now, and then a bunch of younger players who are going to keep getting better, but they are not likely going to get so much better as to make up for the stars that we have right now. And so the next iteration of a Mariners team that's going to be as good as this one will probably be a very different looking team.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's got to be playoffs for me to call it success. And I think last year, even though they came up short, I still thought it was a moderate success.
It was a success. Considering, they were 10 games over 500.
Right, and that's the thing to look at.
That's a success.
I mean, they had a big swing from the previous year in terms of wins, and they were one game out of the playoffs, so that's a good season. But I think this year is the year they have to make the playoffs, at least for me, to say, okay, now that was a successful season.
Yeah. It's hard for me to say that they have to make the playoffs because to me that depends so much on what other teams do. And like the Astros could just be world beaters this year and the Rangers could too. I mean, it's really difficult, I think, with they have to make the playoffs.
What I'll say is I think there's a difference between this season being a success and sort of it being a referendum on DePoto or on the organization. Yes. I don't think it's a failure of the organization per se. And I don't think that, you know, I would feel differently about the process that they're going with. I just think this team has the best potential to make the playoffs of any team, in the last several years. And I would be very, very I would be far more disappointed if they didn't make it than I would have been in 2015 or 2014, or any of the miserable years prior to that.
I would be disappointed if we are not able to host a playoff game at Safeco Field. It would be so bittersweet to make the playoffs in the wild card game as the visiting team, and then go and lose 7-2 in Boston. You know, that would just be such a crappy way to end, you know, what would have been the almost, you know, probably objectively best Mariner season since 2001.
Well, now you're just being greedy. I mean, you not only want a playoff spot, but you want one at Safeco. I mean, my God, you guys, like, I mean, I would love for these things to happen, but, and I mean, I think that the distinction you make, John, is a really interesting one and an important one. I am content to feel like the franchise is headed in the right way and willing to, for me, DePoto and his vision succeeding is more important than making the playoffs. Like, I would not want to make the playoffs in the wrong way. Does that make sense? Like, 2014, that team was luck, and it would have been great to make the playoffs, but it also didn't feel like it was founded, it felt like it was founded on a lot of luck. If I was the Rangers last year, I might not have felt great about that. I mean, obviously, I would have felt great because I would have won the division, but, you know, I, for me, just for the long term, I want to know, and it's most important to me to know, that the franchise is in good hands, that we are going to see a successful, watchable product for years. Like, we're going to run out. The dark days of the 2000s are going to be behind us, and we're going to see something really exciting happen. And I'm willing to be patient a little bit about that.
I think that's a big thing there, is being patient, because a lot of the fan base,
They're fresh out of patience.
Yeah,
and I think
which is fair. I mean, I don't know. I think it's fair to them to be impatient with.
Absolutely, the team has sucked for so long.
Yeah,
they've been awful. They've been unwatchable. I mean, you know, they were unwatchable in the '70s. They were unwatchable in the '80s. They were unwatchable for large swaths of the '90s. They were unwatchable for pretty much 2002 to 2013-ish, maybe. Like, I mean, just the sheer density of failure is amazing.
FanGraphs, for all of the, you know, talk we did about the projections and how sort of tempered they are, they have the Mariners as the sixth best team in the American League. You know, they have them as the second wildcard team.
All right, that's
that's a good spot to start. And if we think that our outfield defense and the sort of way that the Mariners have been constructed to best suit their field and their team construction is going to let them exceed that, I think that's enough reason to be have a little bit of high expectations.
All right, last question we have from Shane Skladani.
Sorry if we're murdering your name, Shane.
Yeah. Apologies. His question is, how big is Tyler O'Neill's impact in 2017? Kate.
Minimal. Extremely minimal. Maybe maybe late September call-up. And honestly, I 100% believe that if the team is in a position where they're doing well or if they're doing poorly, and the Tacoma team is winning, I think they're going to leave Tyler in Tacoma and have him try to lead that team to a championship.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see, I mean, with all the outfield depth we have, I mean, we'd have to have two guys go down pretty much for Tyler to have any kind of impact or even called up. And this is even if he has a decent to pretty good year in Tacoma. This is a big year for him down there. He really has to show that what he learned last year can translate into a higher level, which I hope it will, but we'll have to wait and see.
If he's hitting, I think they have plenty of reason to bring him up and have him in the rotation as sort of an outfield option and a pinch hitting option. But I think Kate, as you said, there has been a fair amount of commitment to letting guys get at-bats, especially getting high competitive, like high-intensity at-bats to prepare the entire organization to have this sort of winning mentality. So,
yeah. I mean, they left Tyler in Jackson all last year. He could have easily come up and hit in AAA. He could have started having, if they wanted to fast-track him, he could have started to have that exposure. But it's like, and it's obviously something, because you never hear anything about him being frustrated or wanting to move up more quickly. I mean, I'm sure he does, but I think he has done a great job of buying in to the plan that they have. I think they've communicated, which is not something that I thought was a hallmark of the Jack Z era. They've communicated with him really clearly. This is our plan for you. This is what we see you doing. Once you come up, you're not going back. Like, we're not going to bust you back down to AAA. Yeah. It's not going to be like a thing where you kind of go back and forth. Once you're here, you're here. Mm-hmm. So,
and he's still only 21. Still very young.
His impact will be smaller than his biceps. There is my prediction for 2017, which are admittedly rather large.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's not exactly the highest bar to clear, but maybe less deep than his voice.
Yes.
And that's all we have. That's all the questions. All
right. Well, thank you so much, those of you who sent in questions for us. Please continue to send them in and leave us your feedback. If you are an iTunes user, if you rate and review the podcast, we really appreciate that. It helps us find other listeners, people who want to hear us prattle about Mariners baseball forever. Thank you so much, Grant, for joining us and lending your expertise on contracts.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, thank you, Jose. Thank you, John. And thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time.